you know, not only are you juggling a million things when in your 40s and 50s, like your kids and your work and your relationship and your aging parents and, you know, career stresses, your hormones are going crazy and you're supposed to be like still holding it all together.
Hi, welcome to Resonate, conversations and life lessons from Rancho La Puerta. Thanks for tuning in today. My guest today is Dr. Shefali Patel. Dr. Patel is a board certified OBGYN. After she had kids and started to age, she became very interested in the transitions that happen to women through different phases in their life. Her specialty now is perimenopause, menopause, and hormone replacement therapy. Dr. Patel was a presenter here at the ranch this past year, and I noted that her classes were completely full. Admittedly, I'm one of 50% of the population who doesn't have ovaries or a uterus, but I certainly know a lot of people that do. Our bodies are so unique and amazing, and I'm looking forward to having a better understanding of how unique they are and how each one of our bodies are different. Hi, Shefali. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Barry. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you? You look like you're somewhere cold.
I am. I am in New Jersey. I wish we were doing this at Rancho La Puerta, but unfortunately, I just have to envision it.
Well, next time we can. So, yes. So you're an OBGYN. So I kind of want to just talk a little bit about your journey. What made you interested in studying that in medical school?
Actually, it's really interesting. I went to medical school thinking that I was going to be an ophthalmologist. When I was 5 years old, I ended up needing to have corrective eye surgery. You know, it had been managed and followed since I was 2 years old. You know, I had the patch and the glasses and all of this. Finally, they needed to do surgery. And even though I was really young, I loved the fact that somebody had the power to like fix me, you know, like that I had this very like finite procedure and then the glasses were gone. And honestly, to this day, I don't wear contacts or glasses. I'm probably at the point where I probably need readers at this point at 52, but, you know, it's worked for whatever, 45 plus years. So I did a lot of volunteering in high school. I always loved the STEM, you know, subjects and sciences. And I went to medical school thinking I was going to be an ophthalmologist. And I did this 3-week rotation in ophthalmology, and it was the most boring thing ever. I was like, I cannot sit in a dark room and look at someone's eyeballs. But I wanted to do something very hands-on still. So I loved my OB rotation. I loved the delivering of babies. I loved women's health. And I loved all the surgeries that came with it. So I felt like it had enough to keep me interested and to keep me excited, you know, for years to come, you know, in terms of going to work. And I loved the office-based practice that a surgical field offered, whereas most of them don't. You know, if you have your appendix out, you usually don't see your general surgeon ever again. You know, same thing if you have like a knee surgery, you usually don't see your orthopedist again. So this was a nice way to be able to have an office practice and be able to do surgery and then deliver babies.
But you don't focus on the delivering the babies anymore, is that correct?
Yeah, no, I stopped actually about 17 years ago. So my second child, when she was born, I just felt like the work-life balance in terms of doing the OB was just not there. And I wasn't able to spend the time that I wanted with my family and specifically with my kids. So I transitioned to just GYN only. And yeah, coming up this year in May will be 18 years since I've delivered my last baby.
You use holistic approaches as well as medical, is that correct?
Yeah, you know, I try to approach my patients as a whole person. So holistic in the sense that I want to address their mental health. I want to address their nutritional health. I want to see, you know, how they're doing in terms of their exercise. You know, I'm very much a believer in modern medicine and Western medicine, but I feel like we've kind of become very fragmented in the way that we deal with patients. You know, we send them to an endocrinologist or a rheumatologist or a nutritionist, and there's very little now where you're actually looking at the whole patient. And especially for women's health, and I feel like, especially women's life in the midlife transition, we have to look at the whole patient. We have to look at everything that's going on.
Is there something you wish that women would understand about their bodies as they move through different stages in their life?
I think that what I would want to tell my patients is that, you know, each part of your transition, you know, each decade of your life, it can still be wonderful. And I think that's ultimately like the message that I want. A lot of times when women hit perimenopause or menopause, and so many things are acutely changing and things feel so different than they ever did. And, you know, there's an end of a certain era, right? Like your ovaries are no longer working. That's what menopause really means. A lot of women think that, you know, a certain part of their life is over, or there's certain things they just have to get used to dealing with. And that might be true, but you can still thrive and you don't have to survive. And that, I love that. And that's the thing that I always try to kind of be the ultimate message that I give my patients. Like, things might be different, but they can still be really good.
Right. And since you brought it up, there's some confusion, I think, sometimes with perimenopause, when it starts, what to expect. How do you explain that to your patients? And what's the difference between, there's perimenopause, like premenopause, then menopause, and then is there a postmenopause?
So menopause and postmenopause are the same thing. So menopause is the most definitive diagnosis we have in clinically. It's in a 1 year of no period in a woman who's otherwise normally menstruating. So not surgery, not anything else stopping your period, just like if you were regularly getting your period, you would just go a full year. On average, that's about 51 or 52. You know, the range can be 47 to 52 on average. And it's a bell-shaped curve. So there's some women that go through it before and some that go through it after. So when that happens, your menopausal, postmenopausal, whatever you want to consider it, that's that definition. Perimenopause is the years leading up to it. And, you know, it can be 5 to 8 years beforehand that you can start to notice some changes. Yeah. Because the ovaries don't acutely just stop, right? They don't just one day decide, hey, this is the day I'm done. They slowly start to taper off. And so perimenopause is actually probably the toughest time in a woman's life to really treat, because the hormones are kind of doing this. They're like up and down. You know, one day you're here and the next day you're here. And, you know, you don't know what you're going to get. Like, every day is a different day, and that's the hardest part for your brain, your metabolism, your hormones, everything to really kind of acclimate to.
Are there certain symptoms that are of perimenopause that get thrown into other categories? People think it's something else than maybe being a perimenopause symptom.
Yeah, you know, I think that there's probably some overlap too. Like, I think that starting in your 40s, like some PMS symptoms intensify, and then that kind of transitions into perimenopause and then menopause. But if something is feeling very different to you, you definitely should bring it up to your doctor and have it addressed, because other things can be going on at the same time. You know, sometimes endocrine conditions like hypothyroidism or thyroid conditions, something maybe going on with your adrenal glands, like vitamin deficiencies, like they can also present as some of the same symptoms of perimenopause. So if something is really feeling like acutely wrong, or just, you know, not really jiving with what you think menopause should be, or it doesn't feel right to you in general, you're not the one as a patient that should be sussing it out. You know, go to your doctor, talk to them and explain your symptoms. And sometimes investigating further with blood work or imaging, things like that, can really help to figure out if there's something else going on, or if we can chalk this all up to perimenopause.
So, and you mentioned that there's an average age of, say, 47 to 52 that women will start menopause. But then is it just last forever after that? Is it just like, is there a beginning to an end to menopause? But there's just a beginning and then it just goes for the rest of your life?
Well, then you're just considered to be postmenopausal, but the most acute symptoms are usually in the first like 5 to 10 years for most women. There are some patients of mine that are in their 60s and are over 10 years, and they're still having hot flashes and night sweats. But for most women, the most intense symptoms that they will feel will be as they're going through it and for the first 5 to 10 years.
So at my age now, I have a lot of female friends that are in menopause, or some are even, you know, on the other side of the beginning of menopause. And so it seems like, as a guy who doesn't talk about it very much, it was always something that it was just something you had to get through. Menopause is just something that's going to happen to everyone and you just got to get through it.
Right.
But it's just another chapter in life, right? And what our body is going to do in the cycle of this life.
You know, and to a certain extent, you're right. But, you know, we weren't meant to live so long. Like, if you even just think about the advent of antibiotics and all the advances that we've made in public health, the early 19th century, most people, not just women, were living, you know, to 60s. Like, so you were maybe living 10 years postmenopausally. You weren't living to 84 or 85. So now you're living a third of your life without this very essential hormone that you've had for most of your life. And then the ramifications of that we're realizing now is, you know, the increase in cardiovascular disease, the increase in metabolic disease, osteoporosis, like all these things that are linked to the hormones changing and the estrogen dropping. So it's not just the symptoms, I think. And I think that's a big shift recently, that it's not just about changing the hot flashes and the night sweats and sort of saying, you know, we can treat you and sort of help with your symptoms. Now we're looking at longevity and wellness and the role that the female hormones have in protecting women from this.
So I think one of the biggest questions surrounding menopause is hormone replacement therapy. And what is that? And you know, there's certain ages that you should start it, and there's certain ages that you no longer should start it. And it's kind of there was a while there that seemed like it had a bad connotation as well.
No, definitely. So, you know, I would say like the peak use of hormone replacement therapy was in like the late 1990s, early 2000s. You know, we in the year 2000, about 25% of menopausal women were on hormone replacement therapy. And I was a resident back then at Sinai, and we knew anecdotally that estrogen had such protective, you know, benefits for women in terms of their dementia and Alzheimer's risk and heart disease. So we kind of, you know, if anybody was symptomatic, we started them on HRT. We didn't have a lot of choices. Mainly it was a pill, and it was a synthetic estrogen actually derived from pregnant horses, Prempro, pregnant mares. And then the big Women's Health Initiative study came out in 2002. And, you know, everything that we thought was true based on their initial analysis was not. So they stopped the study and everybody came off of it. They said, you know, there's a big splashy headlines, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Good Morning America and Matt Lauer, everybody was like, women should come off of hormones. This is increasing your risk of heart, you know, strokes and blood clots and breast cancer. And then we kind of deprived a whole generation of women from HRT after that for about 20 years. And just recently now in the 2020s, it's kind of made a resurgence with newer data coming out from Europe, some American data, some Australian data, that actually that initial analysis was a little bit faulty. If you looked at women that were just going through menopause, so if you were 50 to 59, you still had all the benefits of decreased breast cancer, decreased heart disease, decreased rates of Alzheimer's and dementia, decreased colon cancer. It was that the age group was so wide that they were studying. It was 50 to 69, and the average age in the study was 63. 63-year-old woman is very different than a 50-year-old woman who's acutely going through menopause. So hormone replacement therapy is generally three hormones. You know, where your ovaries making estrogen, progesterone, and testosterone. Most commonly, it's estrogen and progesterone because those are the two that are FDA approved. So we now know that giving the estrogen transdermally, meaning doing it as a patch or gel or even a vaginal ring, and not taking it orally, not having it metabolized by your liver, is a lot safer for women. Decreases the risk of blood clots, decreases the risks of strokes or those thromboembolic events, and even the possible risk of breast cancer because of those free radical formations. We give that as a patch, and then we do an oral progesterone. The metabolism of progesterone in the liver is actually kind of nice because it releases a lot of good GABA and kind of helps you to relax. Progesterone is the feel-good, happy, dopey, sleepy hormone. So the combination of the two, one helps with the hot flashes, prevent, you know, protection of bone, heart, brain, and the other one is really kind of helping a lot with your mood and sleep. And then the third one is testosterone, which the FDA has not approved yet. We're hoping it will be within the next 2 or 3 years. It is approved for use in women in Australia and certain parts of Europe. And that's the other one that the ovary really makes. And actually, believe it or not, before menopause, you have a little bit more circulating testosterone than you do estrogen if you actually look at the total amounts that are in your blood. So testosterone has three benefits. Everyone kind of thinks of it as just being the libido driver, but it can help obviously with libido and sexuality. It's also the major driver for women, just like it is for men. Helps with like mental clarity and fatigue and, you know, just feeling a little bit more sharp. And then the third thing is protecting your bones and protecting the muscle mass that you have. Women lose a lot of muscle in midlife and especially in perimenopause and menopause. And the testosterone can kind of help with what we call sarcopenia or loss of muscle. So, you know, and as we are doing more and more longevity, and you guys, you know, there were a lot of talks at Rancho La Puerta when I was there just a couple of weeks ago about, you know, lifting weights and which tie to having more muscle mass and longevity.
Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that the ovaries actually make testosterone as well. It just kind of shows how related our body parts are, men and women.
Yeah.
So do all the hormone levels include, so testosterone also drops at a certain age during menopause for women?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because testosterone is made in the ovaries and a little bit of it is made in your adrenal glands and in the fatty tissues of your body. So it may not drop down to almost zero, which the estrogen levels will for most women, but it'll drop significantly. And in some cases will be undetectable or very, very low amounts.
So in the past, I feel like using the synthetic that came from a horse was one of the things that was considered a red flag. Mm-hmm. What are they using for the new hormone replacements?
So it's estradiol, which is more similar to what your body's making. So it's more bioidentical. So bioidentical can be made in big pharma. You don't have to have it compounded in a special pharmacy. Right. You can get a prescription and pick it up at CVS or Walgreens. But chemically, it's estradiol, which is very similar to what your body was making. And then again, it's transdermal. So most women are getting it as a patch that they change twice a week, or a gel that they apply and air dry every morning. Or there's even a vaginal ring that you can insert and slowly releases it through the vagina, and it's absorbed that way. The oral Prempro is almost never used. Every once in a while, I'll see a patient on it who's been on it for a long time, or maybe has, you know, a doctor that really hasn't kept up with some of the changes in HRT, and, you know, we'll try and transition them over to something that, you know, may be a little bit more natural to what their body was making and a little safer for them.
So estradiol also includes progesterone then?
No. So progesterone is a separate compound. So you have to get the estrogen and progesterone.
So is it the estrogen that's hard on the liver to digest then?
Yeah. So when the estrogen gets broken down in the liver, it makes more free radicals and it makes more things that can be detrimental to your blood clotting and blood clots and stroke. The progesterone, when it's metabolized by the liver, actually releases some nice byproducts that actually help you to relax and sort of chill out and feel a little more, you know, even keeled and sleep better. Progesterone can be a game changer for sleep.
I need a little of that then. I would imagine that not every woman is going to need the same levels of all these different hormones. So do you test each person individually to see where their levels are, and then you just try to keep them in a certain level or range?
So actually, that's a really good question. We don't normally check levels. So we know that everything's going to be kind of low. And depending on your age and how far you are into the whole perimenopause and menopause journey, we pick a dosage and then we titrate it based on your symptoms. And the reason for that is because the normal estrogen levels are so varied. Like a normal estrogen can be between 50 and 350 to 400 in most labs. And that's because, that's because the normal menstrual cycle has such fluctuations in the estrogen as well. So if you're at the very beginning of your period, your estrogen is going to be very low. It'll be closer to 50. If you're in the middle of your cycle around day 14, when you're getting ready to release that egg and ovulate, it'll be like 200 or 300. And then right before your period, it's going to be somewhere in between because that, you know, the egg is not fertilized. Mm-hmm. You're about to get your period and the levels are dropping. So, you know, me at the age of 35, and let's say you are a woman, you at the age of 35, we may have lived at different numbers. So to artificially treat each woman to, let's say, a level of 200 or 150, it's very artificial. So we don't normally follow blood levels, and you don't need, you know, blood tests to be diagnosed as being menopausal or even perimenopausal, you know? So we do that based on symptoms pretty much. The only times that we do check blood levels when it does become important is if somebody is on therapy and is not feeling any better. So normally when I start my patients on HRT, I check in on them again in 6 to 8 weeks, you know, I either see them as a visit or a telehealth, like, hey, how's it going? they're like, I feel no different. Not that I don't feel fully better or, you know, I'm having side effects. Mm. I feel nothing. Then maybe they're just not good absorbers. So, you know, when you're giving the medication through the skin, some women just don't absorb it as well. And so that might be a time to check levels. So if they've been on appropriate therapeutic doses of estrogen, but the blood work doesn't reflect that, then they may be somebody that needs to take it orally, even if it's going to get metabolized by their liver. If somebody was feeling really great on it and all of a sudden isn't, that's another time to check the levels. If we're going to put you on testosterone therapy, we always check levels because giving too much testosterone can really have some bad side effects for women. So that is something that I watch very carefully, and I make sure that the patients are in a very tight therapeutic range with testosterone. But the other two hormones, estrogen and progesterone, we don't need to follow those.
So is there a standard therapeutic dose that you would give? It's based on the number of symptoms and the severity of the symptoms?
And the age. So if a patient is like 52, you know, and she's going, you know, through the thick of it, she may need a little bit more. If somebody's 55 or 56, her needs may be changing. You know, I also kind of look at the BMI and the size of the patient, how much, you know, I think that they're going to need. But really, it's based on like their symptoms and really where they are in their menopause journey. And that can also change. You know, somebody who's in perimenopause at 48 or 49, who's still making some estrogen of their own, they may need more when they go officially fully through menopause and they're making no more estrogen. That same patient closer to 58 or 59, when, you know, she's a few years into it, may need a little less because her symptoms will naturally go down a little bit, you know?
My name is Barbara. I live mostly in New York City, although I spend my summers in Madison, Wisconsin, where I lived for 40 years. I was at the ranch 3 times in the late 90s, and then my life went in other directions. But this winter had an opportunity to return, and it's been just a wonderful experience. I do a hike every morning. I wake up, because I'm still on Eastern time, I wake up about 4:30, so the 6 o'clock hikes are just perfect for me. So I do a hike. I tend to do a 9 o'clock class, a 10 o'clock class. I do stretching. I've done yoga. Today I did dance, which was a lot of fun. After this, I'm going to go and do aerial yoga, which I understand is in a hammock. So I'm looking forward to that. I try to swim here every day, and mostly the pool. Nobody swims here. I've never seen anybody else. I've had the pools all to myself. You know, I think I'm lucky. Partly, I think I have decent genes. But I do take care of myself. You know, I exercise. I exercise pretty much every day. And I also keep my brain active. So it's a wide range of activities and interests. So I keep busy. And I have a good life.
I hope you're enjoying today's podcast as much as I am. To learn more about our wonderful presenters and exciting weeks coming up at the ranch, go to rancholaporta.com and check out our events calendar. Make sure to mention the podcast when making your reservation to take advantage of a special offer. Some restrictions may apply. I hope you are enjoying today's podcast as much as I am. To learn more about our wonderful presenters and exciting weeks coming up at the ranch, go to rancholaporta.com and check out our events calendar. Make sure to mention the podcast when making your reservation to take advantage of a special offer. Some restrictions may apply. You had mentioned just to me and personally that the FDA has called for removal of the black box warning. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? What is the black box warning?
Yeah. So when in 2002, when the Women's Health Initiative study came out and they stopped the trial and they said that HRT was dangerous, they put a black box warning on every estrogen product. So every pill, every patch, every cream came with this big black box warning on the box of medication that said, you know, this may cause stroke, breast cancer, death. Like, you know, black box warning is like one of the scariest things the FDA can put on a medication. Like, it just gives you pause. And a lot of times patients would go fill their prescription, see this black box warning, and then be like, I don't feel safe, Dr. Patel. Like, look at this. Look at all the things that it can cause. So in November, we thought they were just going to lift it off the vaginal estrogen cream. but they actually took the black box warning off of all estrogen products based on new data that shows that it's not harmful. And that was a major blow for women's health.
I would imagine that there's a lot of medical doctors that are not specifically trained in menopause and hormonal therapy. Mm-hmm. So if what advice do you have for someone seeking out a doctor, or if they have a doctor, a lot of people have to stick to their doctor that they have on their plan.
Yeah.
What are some of the questions that they should ask? What are some of the things that they should be looking for?
So they really should have a conversation with their doctor, and their doctor should be able to give them basically options like of what they can be treated with. And the options should include HRT for most patients. I mean, there's obviously patients mm-hmm. that are not going to be good candidates. And those, contraindications are very specific, and there's 3 or 4 of them. But for most patients, if your doctor is unwilling to even have the conversation with you about hormone replacement therapy, then it may be time to look for a different doctor. The person that delivered your mm-hmm. kids or, had you on birth control since you were 18 may not be the person to basically manage you in HRT, because they just may not be current, or they may just not feel comfortable. And there should be a menu of things that should be offered to you. You can take just progesterone for the sleep. You could be on just testosterone for the libido. You could be on just vaginal estrogen cream for painful sex and recurrent UTIs. So there should be things that are given to you as options and different ways of taking it. Some patients don't like the patch because they don't like to have something that looks like a dirty Band-Aid. Some patients mm-hmm. don't like the gel because they don't want to wait till it dries every morning. So there should be a lot of options. If not, there are some online providers now. There are a couple mm-hmm. of really good online providers, because there are patients in some parts of the country, like you said, that might only have one town doc. And if that guy is not comfortable, or that gal is not comfortable giving it to you, then what are their choices? There's now some good online platforms that really have opened up access to HRT. And one of them is there's MIDI. There's a bunch of them that are out there. That might be another option for patients.
So they would actually talk to a physician on those online?
Mm-hmm. Or a nurse practitioner, yeah. Or a mid-level okay. practitioner, yeah.
When the study came out, and then HRT was considered bad for a series of, how many years was that it was considered?
Probably about 20 years almost. Like I would say, 2002 to about 2020.
So what happened to all those women that went through menopause during those 20 years?
A lot of them were deprived of HRT, and a lot of them didn't get it. And they are now dealing with the sequelae of osteoporosis, some of the heart issues. Some of us continued to prescribe it. And we were also, met with a lot of pushback. Like sometimes I would have my patient on estrogen and she would say, oh, my cardiologist is not happy that I'm on HRT because I, have high cholesterol, or my neurologist is not happy because they're worried that I'm going to, have a stroke. So I think that the black box warning removal has legitimized it, not just to the patients, but also to the medical mm-hmm. community, that this is a safe and efficacious treatment. And if they're not comfortable, then they have to refer their patients to somebody who is. But we can't just tell patients that it's not an option and use fear-mongering as a way of, detracting women from going on it.
Mm-hmm. And is there a window of time that you can start HRT during the process? And then is there a point where you've gone too far and you can't start it?
So we think that the optimal time is within the first 10 years of going through menopause or your period stopping, or by age 60. And that doesn't mean that if you are past 60 or more than 10 years that you can't use it, that you still may not be a candidate for it. We just don't know that you will have all those beneficial preventative benefits mm-hmm. of it. But if you are, let's say, 62 and you're still having a lot of hot flashes or night sweats, or you've been diagnosed with osteoporosis and you want to see if maybe it will help you with your overall health, you can definitely still try it. We just don't have the numbers and the data to support how much of a beneficial impact it's going to have on you. We definitely know that most of that is derived if you start it within the first 5 to 10 years.
Yeah. And so by the time you're, say, 62, the acute symptoms are probably past. Mm-hmm. And so we're talking about the things that are like long-term, like preventing osteoporosis, decline in mental functioning, and those kind of things.
Yeah. And then there are still some patients that have some symptoms, you know, some vaginal dryness, painful sex, you know, they feel like their hair, their skin, their nails are different. And occasionally some of them are still having hot flashes and night sweats. Like I still have some patients that are like, it's not regularly, but every once in a while. With sleep, sleep is a big one that patients come in with, even in their 60s, where they feel like they're just not getting a good restful night's sleep. They're getting up at 3 a.m. So some symptoms can still persist. And again, you may not need everything. You know, you might decide, I might just want to do progesterone and vaginal estrogen, or I might just want to do testosterone and vaginal estrogen, or maybe you want to do all of it. But again, it has to be very tailored and very catered to what you're going through.
Yeah, it's complicated, isn't it?
It is. Women are complicated.
Women, I've heard that before. Being naive like I am, you know, I was talking to my daughter. I saw her this weekend. We were talking about how crazy it is that a woman's whole hormonal cycle does this every month, where a man's is a little bit more like, you know, we go through andropause, I suppose, but it's so not extreme compared to what women go through. So.
Definitely, because our ovaries are our gonads, right? So when our ovaries stop functioning, it's the equivalent of, you know, a man having a testicle removed, right? If you had testicular cancer, you would immediately be given testosterone. Nobody would even think twice about it, right? Like they would be like, he's a man and he's not making it anymore. He should get it. And, you know, we didn't treat women the same way for a long time. And then we kind of, you know, and then, you know, there's so many, even going back to TV shows years back, like there's so many, you know, kind of, they're not even called memes back then, but like there's so many jokes about women and their mood changes and all the stuff that happens with menopause and perimenopause, but it's real. Like, you know, not only are you juggling a million things when in your 40s and 50s, like your kids and your work and your relationship and your aging parents and, you know, career stresses, your hormones are going crazy and you're supposed to be like, still holding it all together.
Yeah, I mean, a little more understanding would be nice, huh?
A little bit, and a little compassion, right?
Something you just said that made me think of something kind of strange is that, so your ovaries, when they stop producing eggs, right? Then is it dangerous for a body to have organs or things that are not functioning in it? Because like your testicles can produce you know, sperm until the day you die.
Right.
Where once your ovaries stop doing the function that they were put there to do, it seemed like maybe it's safe to get rid of them.
Well, you know, the risk of ovarian cancer is still very, very low without a strong family history or if you're not like a BRCA carrier. The ovarian cancer risk is really low. It's only like about 3% for the general population. You know, it's a good question, but it doesn't really increase your risk of anything bad happening.
Okay. It just dawned on me that maybe, you know, that might be a problem because it does seem like the whole female anatomy, like I know so many women that have like their uteruses out or, you know, but they try to keep their ovaries. And what would be the reason of keeping your ovaries if you're through menopause?
If you're completely through menopause, a lot of times now we are taking the ovaries if you're having surgery for another indication, but you're still making a little bit of androgens. Okay. Like you could still be making a little bit of testosterone. You're not making a lot of estrogen and progesterone, but you're still making a little bit of testosterone. But it all depends on when you're going through that and having the surgery. So let's say they saw mass on your uterus and you're 60 years old. The oncologist is probably going to take everything at that point. But if you're 50 or 47, you're still going to benefit from your own hormones and you're still going to, you know, benefit from them producing, even if it's less, for as long as you can.
And these are maybe more off topic a little bit, but during menopause, a lot of my friends have said that they feel like there's nothing they can do. They just tend to gain weight. Mm-hmm. And I read somewhere that the average woman will gain 11 to 13 pounds through menopause.
Yeah.
Is that true? And there's nothing you can do about that?
I mean, you can definitely try. I mean, we tell patients things that they can do. But yeah, but on average, through perimenopause and menopause, most women will gain about 1.5 pounds a year. So if you think about this going on for about 8 to 10 years, it's a significant amount of weight. And it's multi reasons why it's happening. One is that, you know, the estrogen is, estrogen, when it's in your body, it tends to have your estrogen deposited more subcutaneously. So more your thighs, your buttocks, your hips. So not that either one of these shapes is attractive, but you're more of a pear. And then once you start going through perimenopause and menopause, estrogen decreases and testosterone is the more available hormone in that time frame. Even though it's still low, it's more so than what your estrogen was. Mm-hmm. It tends to be more of an anabolic steroid, and it is depositing your estrogen more in the midsection. It's that midsection weight gain. And that visceral fat, the one that's in your intestines and in your belly, is actually the most dangerous because it's very inflammatory. It, you know, is increasing your risk of like insulin glucose dysregulation, increasing your risk of cholesterol. So you'll see all this in perimenopausal, menopausal women. If you follow their blood work, you'll see bump ups in cholesterol of 20 points. Their fasting sugars will go up. Their insulin will go up. It's a very reactive fat. So, you know, what I advise my patients to do is really to focus more on protein intake. You want to make sure you're getting, you know, at least 80 grams of protein on the conservative end, which is almost a full-time job for most women if they're eating that much protein.
88 grams of protein a day?
80 grams of protein a day, yeah. And it could be plant-based. It doesn't have to be all animal-based, but 80 grams of protein. You want to try and decrease your overall carbohydrates to about 100 to 125 grams and really limiting the simple sugars to less than 25. And you really want to start lifting weights and building more muscle. Having more muscle is going to burn more passive calories. It's going to, you know, just help your bone and your muscle structure and just how you look in general, because muscle is obviously helping you with your tone and definition. And you're burning more passive calories with muscle than you are with fat. So lifting heavy, you shouldn't be able to do more than 4 to 6 reps of something, you know, 3 sets. Probably only twice a week. You don't need to lift 4 or 5 times a week. If you're lifting that much, you're not allowing your body to recover properly. You're trying to get at least 7,500 to 10,000 steps in every day. So really moving your body as much as you can. And, you know, those things can all help. It may not fix everything. You know, I myself experienced it too. You know, there's about 8 to 10 pounds that I'm up, and it's very, very hard. Like everything that worked 5 to 10 years ago doesn't work anymore. You know, like the other thing you can try is also intermittent fasting. That's definitely helped a lot of my patients, you know, doing 16 hours of a fast and only eating in an 8-hour window or even a 6-hour window. Trying to tell my patients not to eat after dinner. So after 7 or 8 o'clock, try not to eat, you know, all those things can help because it's all about your insulin and glucose regulation and the way that the hormones are affecting it.
Yeah. And so lifting weights is something you brought up, and for women to lift weights, women are always like, well, I don't want to get too big and bulky. But when a woman lifts weights, does it help to boost the testosterone levels in her? Because they say for men it does that too.
Yeah, definitely. It helps your mood, helps your libido. You definitely help, you know, you get a little boost in your testosterone when you lift weights as well. And I think that if you're lifting and you're lifting heavy and you're doing it the way that you're supposed to, not, you know, like the 5 or 10 pound weights, if you can do 20 or 30 reps, you're not really doing anything for your muscles. You're not really training them. Right. So I know women are worried about getting bulky, but it's very hard to get bulky. Like, and I think even as a man, right? Like in your 60s, you know, it's very hard, even if you're lifting.
Apparently you've seen me.
That wasn't directed to you specifically, but even, you know, it's hard. Like even my friends that are men, they're like, you know, we're doing everything the way we were doing before, and it's very hard to hold on to that. So I think that a lot of the women that are worried about getting big and bulky, I think that that's, you know, something that I generally try to tell them that it's going to be very hard for them all of a sudden to have, you know, big muscular thighs and big guns.
And it's hard not to talk about osteoporosis when we talk about menopause. Is estrogen the protector of your bones?
Estrogen is a major protector of your bones. And then also there are things that you can do to protect your bone that are not just estrogen based, and walking is one of them. Lifting weights is the other one of them, and having impact, you know, like we're learning a lot about jumping or even just hopping, skipping. If you can't do, you know, jumps or big box jumps and things like that, but getting off and like having that repetitive impact, it basically sends a vibration through your bones, and the bone is constantly being remodeled. So there's something that's breaking it down called the osteoblasts, and then there's something laying it down called the osteoclasts. So you really want that to be going on all the time. And the more you walk and the more stress there is on your body, you know, even with lifting weights for your upper body, that really helps to continuously remodel the bone. And then, you know, the thing is, once you have osteoporosis, there's no reversal or cure, right? Like, you're not trying to get you back to normal. You're really trying to minimize further loss or, you know, improve a little bit. So once you're already there, it's a little too late. We're going to have our, you know, our peak bone mass by the time that we're 30, and we lose a little bit of it into menopause, and then it's like a sharp decline, and then it kind of evens out, right? So you really want to start, even with, if you have like your daughter, you know, my daughter, calcium, you know, having them strength train and exercise when they're younger, which, you know, this newer generation is really into. Like, my 17-year-old goes to the gym and lifts weights. Like, she wants to be strong. And it's very different from when I was 17. You know, we used to just do cardio and step aerobics and, you know, things like that, and step classes. So you want to focus on the women that are in your life, even if they're younger, you know, to really make sure that their diet is balanced, that they're getting calcium, they're getting vitamin D, that they're exercising, because that's when you're really building your bone. And then, you know, making sure that you're continuing those supplements through perimenopause and menopause. And, you know, estrogen can definitely help. There are some women that are at increased risk if you have other medical conditions, if you've been on other medicines, you know, if you have a strong family history, if you're really underweight, if you're light, you know, these are all things that are risk factors. But ask for a bone density. Like, we don't want to wait till you're 65 to find out you're osteoporotic. Like, find out where you are within 2 years of your last period. That's usually when I send my patients. So if you went through menopause at 52, like, you should be having a bone density of 54 or 55, just so that we know where you stand. If everything's great, perfect. We don't have to check it again for another 3 to 5 years. But if we're already starting to see some bone loss, or if you already have osteoporosis, then you know what? You want to know that then. You don't want to know it when you slip and fall at 60 or 65, because that's what some of the recommendations are right now. They're saying wait till you're 60 or 65 to check it. But I think having that information early on is really important too. And that's, these are some of the things that women who may have felt that they missed their window of HRT can still be doing. Like, you could be proactive about finding out about your bone density, taking your calcium, taking your vitamin D, making sure you're exercising. So, like, you know, and that's kind of getting back to our beginning message. It's like, you know, because you may not have started HRT doesn't mean that you're out of the window for where you can still do good things for yourself and still continue to be, you know, striving to be your healthiest self.
So is calcium supplementing with calcium, is that effective? And, like, how much calcium does someone need to take?
You want to be getting about 1,200 to 1,500 milligrams from your diet. If you can get it from your diet, that's the best, and it's the best absorbed. So green leafy vegetables, those little fish with bones in it, they're always listed as one of the things. I don't know who actually
sardines.
Eats sardines out of cans.
Yes. Yes.
Kind of gross.
I hate them. Yeah,
Nuts, almond milk. If you eat dairy, yogurt, cottage cheese, you know, things like that are all great sources of calcium.
The goal, if you lay down the maximum amount of your bone mass when by the time you're 30, then it's just a matter of trying to maintain it by doing things like resistive training and walking and, you know,
and getting your supplements and eating healthy.
Yeah. And getting your supplements.
Yeah.
Okay. So then, of course, you know, I'm not going to let you get away without talking about libido. Like, you know, since I'm gay, all my female friends my age tell me everything. And they're just like, I turned 50, 55, and I'm done with sex. I don't need it anymore. I don't even have a desire anymore.
Yeah.
So I've heard women tell me that. Is that part of the menopause thing that happens to people?
It is. And I think it's multifactorial. Some of it is definitely hormonal. So as estrogen exits the body and as testosterone decreases, you're not going to feel as sexual. Like, and then when the estrogen drops, like, the mechanics are not as comfortable either. Like, so the vagina is dry. It's not as elastic. It's not making the same secretions. It doesn't have the same response to sexual stimuli. But that's easy to fix. Like, the mechanics are the easiest part to fix. Vaginal estrogen cream, everybody should be on it because it's like a moisturizer for your vagina. You can be on it even if you, most cases, if you've had breast cancer, you know, because very little, if any, is absorbed in your body. It's just topical. Mm-hmm. And it can be a game changer, not just for sex, but for recurrent UTIs, vaginal infections, you know, things like that. and a good lubricant. So vaginal estrogen, a good lubricant can fix the mechanics. The desire part is very multifactorial for women, and it's very hard to fix. And that's why there's no easy fix, right? Like, because it's not about the erection. It's not taking a Cialis or a Viagra and being able to achieve an erection, because for women, it's very different, you know, and you're not even talking about the ability to orgasm. You're just talking even about the drive, right? Like about the desire. So sometimes going on HRT can make a big difference. Like if you feel better, if you're sleeping better, if your mood is better, you know, then it's on your radar again. You know, you're not just in this survival mode of like trying to get through the day, you know, on no sleep and hot flashes and night sweats and all that. Testosterone, you know, major driver for women's libido. It can testosterone is one of those things that I would say is 50-50. Half my patients feel like it makes a huge difference. It also takes a little longer to kick in. It can take 3 to 4 months before you notice a difference on it. With estrogen and progesterone, my patients within a week are telling me that everything's so much better. You know, the sky's bluer, grass is greener, things are great. Testosterone takes a little bit longer, but if it works, it can be a game changer. It can be that missing ingredient for a lot of women, you know, in terms of how they feel and how, you know, their libido. Then there's like some topical stuff that you can do, like, you know, arousal oils and things you can put on the clitoris and the vagina and things like that to kind of help you. So again, very multifactorial and very not an easy answer, but there are answers and there are things that you can do. And sometimes just feeling better and the vagina, the mechanics feeling better might be enough to, because if you're not really feeling it and it hurts and then you're sore afterwards and you get a UTI, like, why would you want to do it?
Well, you got me. I think you kind of, you said it earlier too. Women are complicated. It's multifaceted. It's not just one thing for sure, right? And I think in life in general, you're happier and better at everything if you feel good and you feel good about yourself. So that's awesome.
Because I think, you know, like you said, you know, we touched on the weight gain. And you touch on the hot flashes and the night sweats, and you're like, you're not sleeping. So I mean, think about it. Are you going to feel sexual, right? Like, and you know, I think that that's something, because like we also talked about a little bit, men don't have such huge vacillations in their hormones, in their physique and all those things like the way women do. And so it's harder to relate too. And I think then sometimes it starts causing problems in relationships. Like, you know, the man feels like she doesn't want him anymore. She's not attracted to him. You know, it can cause a lot of stress, like a lot of interpersonal stress too. Like I have a lot of patients that come in and the libido thing sounds like it's not that serious, right? But it really can cause a lot of problems in relationships. And patients are like, you know, my husband really doesn't know why I'm not interested and takes it very personally. And it's hard to understand sometimes.
Yeah. And there's, and I think also that just at the same time menopause is happening, there's a lot of other life transitions happening to people too. Like the kids are going away. Suddenly you're alone with your spouse again, or, you know, your career might be changing or coming to an end. So there's just a lot of extra stress and stressors on you also that probably add to it.
Definitely aging parents, you know, there's,
you mentioned that.
Yeah. There's a lot like that. Women in their 40s and 50s are often dealing with a lot, you know, young adult children or teenagers, you know, dealing with an empty nest sometimes, career stresses. There's a lot.
But on a happy note, we are, have more longevity than we've ever had. We're living longer.
Definitely.
And if we weren't living longer, we wouldn't have these little things to deal with. But it's, you know, when you look at the balance, better to deal with these things and enjoy a longer life.
Definitely. And now we're I think some of the medicine has caught up, at least for women's health, to try and help, you know, women be able to kind of get through this transition and in a healthier way with more options, you know, at least to have the choice and not be told this is just how it has to be. And then, you know, if they're lucky enough to come to Rancho La Puerta and experience wellness and, you know, all of that in person, then that always helps to reset too. I'm still holding on to my Zen, even though I landed in 16 inches of ice and snow.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time, and I hope that I know you'll be back to visit us here at Rancho La Puerta. So
I can't wait.
Thank you for spending some time with me this morning.
Thank you, Verily. It was good to see you again.
Of course, I know that men and women have different bodies, but I was enlightened today after the podcast at just how complex the hormonal makeup is for a woman. Not only is it complex, but it's ever-changing. just in a cycle of a month for a woman, it changes drastically. And then at menopause, it can really change a lot. I'm always amazed how the human body works together. It's kind of a miracle so that humanity can continue. Dr. Patel shared with me that though 50% of the world population is women, only 10% of the research done in healthcare is done on women. So she points out that this is an area for a lot of growth, and it's already growing rapidly. So I'm looking forward to all the new things that we're going to discover. The fact that we are living longer and longer, we have more opportunities to learn about how to navigate the changes that occur in our bodies as we age. I've always had a great appreciation and a great deal of respect for women. Way more today. I joked with Dr. Patel after the podcast that I don't think I'm strong enough to be a woman. Perhaps that's why I chose to be a man this time around. Dr. Patel's advice is to listen to your body and talk to your doctor about what's going on. She said that not all doctors are trained in menopause or hormone replacement therapy. So it's really important to do some research, and there's a lot of great online resources. I look forward to connecting with you next time. Until then, I'm wishing you health and daily joy.